The line between science fiction and science fact is dissolving. What was once on screen only now is becoming a part of our daily lives, including artificial intelligence. But are we ready for it? A new book that explores the popular TV show Westworld might give us an idea. ISU psychology professors Scott Jordan and Eric Wesselman, aka GLT Psych Geeks, chip in with their take on AI and our new relationship with the technology. In Westworld Psychology, Violent Delights, the Psych Geeks examine when and why we see human in the face of AI. And Wesselman says this is where anthropomorphism comes into play.
From a very early age, we learn to simulate other people's mind states, to recognize that you have thoughts, I have thoughts. And I have to kind of take your word for it, but as I'm trying to get an assessment of your thoughts as you're talking, I'm also looking at your nonverbals. I'm trying to imagine your perspective. One of the reasons is that I want to be able to predict your behavior. I want to know, are you honest? Are you trustworthy? Are you telling me the truth, or are you going to stab me in the back? That's important for me to know if I'm going to build a coalition with you, if we're going to hang out. I want you to watch my back. We spend most of our time thinking about other people's thoughts. Researchers who do work on anthropomorphism argue that this is just sort of a spillover onto non-human objects.
Well, I certainly anthropomorphized my stuffed animals when I was a little girl and my dolls and that sort of thing.
Well, and that's actually an important point that, you know, stuffed animals and dolls, right, they look human-ish or humanoid, right? And so although the research suggests we can anthropomorphize just about anything, it's easier the more similar it is to us.
The more something makes movements like we do, the easier it is to resonate to us. Heck, even the more something speaks a language like we do, the easier it is for us to resonate to us. And there are data to indicate if you hear a group speaking in a language you can't speak, you feel outgrouped. So yeah, who do we keep out? Who do we let in?
So in your chapter in the book on Westworld, right away you did this great quote that I loved, and you said, why would people want to enact social fantasies with machines rather than humans? And this is certainly something at the heart of Westworld, but it's something that we have to grapple with increasingly in our lives today.
So we'll start with Westworld, which in these cases, the fantasies that they're enacting are obviously very extremes. Hate to go Freudian, but... Freud argued that sort of the two primal motives that we have sort of ingrained in us as a species is Thanatos and Eros, to destroy and to love, or procreate, or what have you. That's...
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Yes. Say no more. And that's what you see a lot of these characters, the people who the patrons of Westworld, enacting with these robots. And why might they do that? Well, probably the same reason why Freud argued we want to do it but don't, is because society tells us that we shouldn't. And maybe our own internalized moral codes tell us we shouldn't. But in this adult theme park that's Westworld, there really are no laws or rules, so to speak. So they are there to enact these fantasies without any repercussion, right? Whether it be from law or from perhaps their own moral codes. If they don't see these robots as human and human as worthy of moral consideration, then they can do as they please. These robots are tools.
That's kind of nightmarish, though. If you end up getting into a habit of looking at something that is exactly like a human, no uncanny valley there at all, and you think you can do anything you want to this thing in front of you, then what is that going to do to your psyche?
Yeah, I'm not going to be a jerk here, but American slavery was exactly that. Right, we took human beings and treated them like non-humans. What you're doing when you dehumanize someone is as follows. If I insult someone and I make them feel pain, I resonate to that pain. So in order for me not to resonate to their pain, I have to create a cognitive border, we call it dehumanization, that allows me to reframe their pain in a way such that I don't experience it. Now that's at the one-to-one level. And that's where we usually try to say dehumanization is really, existent. But you can look at the infrastructure of an entire city, and you can look at how people are managing who they give empathy to and who they don't by the way the city's laid out. In other words, I just keep myself away from those I don't want to empathize with.
So we're practicing almost for a world where we are going to be inundated with artificial intelligence. We don't seem to be practicing very well to prepare for dealing with these other beings, apparently. Because we're going to have to address whether or not these things have rights. this artificial intelligence has rights.
Now you're going to Star Trek.
Okay.
Measure of a Man, and I'm totally in. Because the answer to that question will have nothing to do with them. It'll have to do with who we are.
This question of do robots, does AI have rights, really kind of cuts to a question that isn't anything particularly new. It's this question of what is human, right? What does it mean to be human? And for me, some of my favorite anime films from the 80s and early 90s, things like Ghost in the Shell, Armitage the Third, etc., dealt very much with this idea of what are the divisions between human and robot and how they really aren't that solid, right? And you could take a step back even further to the Russian playwright Karl Čapek, who wrote R.U.R., Rossum's Universal Robots, and I believe that was late 1800s, early 1900s. And the robots in there weren't like machines, they were clones. But that play was all about, do we have the right to exploit other beings, and how do we draw the lines to make it okay for us to do that? You can have this conversation not just about technology, but about animals. Right, non-human animals, right? I mean, so lots of philosophers have argued about what makes someone uniquely human or not. You know, oh, we can mourn our dead. Oh, we show this type of self-reflection. And then as soon as philosophers make that argument, then research comes out to say, actually, no, these non-human animals here also do something like that, right? So we have to then kind of stop and reassess what we think human is. And I think a lot of that is the debate here.
Do you guys feel that anthropomorphism is a double-edged sword?
I agree with the idea of looking at anthropomorphism and looking at morality in terms of what is human and increasing the circle and the application of that definition. 50 years from now, 100 years from now, human might simply be an ancient concept. As new species emerge, regardless of what they're made of, how are they going to emerge and be able to be a species? As species emerge, in order to be able to sustain themselves as a species, they're going to have to generate borders. They're going to have to generate things that allow them to persist as a species. And that's one of the central premises of the Westworld series, is that the first guy that built the robots thought that individual consciousness was the achievement he was after. That didn't go well, and I won't spoil anything. But his partner takes over later and says, the way I protect these conscious beings is by making them capable of protecting themselves against humans. So Westworld can be seen as a context within which these androids learn what it takes to survive in a world of sociopathic humans. More at the base of this, for me, is in-group, out-group, and group sustainment, whatever we are, to be together in a we. So the trick is, we is changing. What it is to be a we in the United States is changing. The challenge for that new we will be, who are they? And as we continue to become increasingly complex, as we continue to become increasingly inclusive in our definition of we, we'll always need to check, be aware of, who are we calling they, and how does that influence who we are?
But this idea of in-group, out-group, if we were to sort of strip away the sort of human-robot portion and just think about what is this narrative tell us about how we think of others, sort of the polar opposite of anthropomorphism is dehumanization.
Yes.
Right? And when you look historically, you look at Nazi propaganda, for example, not just in Nazi Germany, but you look at neo-Nazi and white supremacist rhetoric now, and much of the language is all about dehumanizing what these groups consider to be the other. And a lot of research on dehumanization argues that that is a key mechanism by which we can justify atrocities against other groups. If we don't see them as human, we then can justify bending our moral code to use them in whatever way we see fit.
Do you think with our assistance, with Siri and with Alexa, are we practicing for the future of AI now?
This is my concern about AI, is actually systems that are built to activate my empathy so that someone else can get my money. So we are practicing, and what we're going to be practicing is what we've been practicing with each other forever, and that is who to keep in and who to keep out. And, you know, the rules that we're going to make about AI are going to end up looking quite a bit like the rules we make about what we call human beings.
There's some research showing that people who are lonely, people who are in retirement homes, et cetera, perhaps, they've been giving them sort of these robot digital interaction partners that do serve sort of a surrogate parasocial function and can improve their psychological outcomes, much like we see in other types of people who are maybe lonely, etc. There is a benefit to that type of parasocial connection. Another set of things that's interesting, and Scott mentioned this idea of rules for AI, is that some research on smart cars, for example, suggests that one of the things that people struggle with this concept of a smart car is what happens if something goes wrong. The program malfunctions and someone is hit and killed. Well, who's at fault now? Some research suggests people who are more likely to anthropomorphize are more likely to blame the smart car, because it should have somehow known better. When we anthropomorphize something, not only does it become beholden to our own moral code, but we also hold it morally accountable as well.
That's Eric Wesselman and Scott Jordan, professors of psychology at Illinois State University and GLT's Psych Geeks. Westworld Psychology, Violent Delights is available from Sterling Books. I'm Laura Kennedy.